Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Quoting now from a press release from Utah State University, the Utah Legislative Auditor General presented today findings of the performance audit of Utah State University's governance, leadership, and culture to the Utah Legislative Audit Subcommittee, talking about this release on Friday. The audit was ordered by the subcommittee after a limited review raised concerns about presidential spending during the tenure of the former president. In the university's response to the audit and its recommendations, USU President Brad Mortensen concurred with the findings and emphasized that the audit presents an opportunity to build better systems for the future. He noted the audit's acknowledgement of recent progress, including actions taken to update policies, strengthen controls, and increase oversight, even prior to receiving the final audit report. Today, we are going to check in with Utah State University President Brad Mortensen. We'll get his reaction to the Utah Legislature's audit of USU. We'll also talk about USU's strategic reinvestment plan mandated by the legislature. We'll ask President Mortensen about his top priorities in general and top takeaways from his recent tour of USU's campuses across the state. Here is that interview recorded on Thursday. We're talking this part of the program with Utah State University President Brad Mortensen. Great to have you on again. Thank you.
Thanks, Tom. Always good to be with you, too.
So we want to talk about legislative audit of USU's processes and controls. And that has delayed the reinvestment money from HB 265 for Utah State University. So maybe we can back up to HB 265, and you've had the dubious honor of doing this twice. He went through this process at Weber State, now at USU. USU, I believe, is the last because the audit has delayed implementation of at least 70% of this money.
Yes, and there was kind of two steps there. The other of the eight degree granting institutions that were affected by HB 265 from the 2025 legislative session, seven of them got approval for their plans in September and had the full amount of the funding restored. And USU, they said at that point they wanted to wait for the new president to get in place. And so when I started on November 10th, then we went back, made a few adjustments in the plan. There were some feedback from legislators about they wanted to make sure we were reflecting Utah State's land grant mission and statewide programs a little bit more. So we made some adjustments in the plan, went back on December 9th, and they kind of said, okay, we like the plan, but there's this legislative audit that will be coming out the end of January. So we'll give you 30% of the money now, and then let's wait and see what comes from the legislative audit. So we're at that point.
So the amount of money here, it comes from, I think it's 10% legislature in HB 265 took 10% of the money they would give to the entire higher education, and USU's portion of that is, what, $12.6 million?
Yeah, just a little over $12 million, and so we got back about a little over four, and so there's still about a little over $8 million, $8.5 million almost, that they're withholding from us now. And those were cuts that we made on one side of the house, and then we were able to reinvest that in programs that supported academic success for our students, that had instructional needs where there were demands from workforce development in specific areas. And so we cut from what were described as underperforming academic programs or areas of administrative bloat to those areas. And in total for USU, that was about $12.6 million.
Tell me a little bit more about the cuts. Academic bloat, I guess, administrative bloat. What are some other areas that were cut?
Well, one of the things we did at Utah State, one of the more visible things is combined academic colleges, to eliminate dean administrative positions, basically. So the College of Agriculture and Applied Sciences was combined with the College of Natural Resources, which is a model that's more common in land-grant universities across the country to have agricultural and natural resources together. So we combined three other colleges, the College of Arts and Humanities and Social Sciences and the College of Sciences into the College of Arts and Sciences. So that allowed some administrative savings in those areas. There were some low enrollment academic programs also that were eliminated but not immediately. All of the students who were in those programs are, we're obligated from our accreditation to teach out a student in those programs once they've declared that as their major. So it's just kind of cutting off the pathway for new students to come into those programs, and we're allowed to space out the cuts over a 3-year period. So hopefully we can teach out the students who are enrolled in those academic programs that were cut or adjusted or consolidated as well.
I recall some legislators were a little concerned about duplication in nursing programs, USU, Weber State. Has that part been resolved?
Yeah, nursing was one of the ones that got some highlights. So we did not expand as much in the revised plan that we took back in December. We didn't expand as much in the nursing area. There was some money that was set aside for a doctor of physical therapy program that we held back on. There's a couple of, not the Utah State won't continue to move in that direction, but there's a couple of other things we need to put in place, especially from a facilities perspective to support that program. So we pulled back on that now. And then a couple of other areas we still invested in, just not as much. But then we did some things like we invested in a statewide water initiative collaborative, a veterinary tech program that will launch at the Blanding campus. And we still have some significant investments in engineering and student success and AI and computer science programs and other areas. So it was, unlike a lot of states, and this we see this in both red and blue states across the country, there have been cutbacks in higher education. But the Utah legislature really, I think, manifested their belief in the importance of higher education. They just want to make sure that we're using the resources as efficiently as possible. So they challenged us to cut and then reinvest. And so that's the process we're going through. And if we do it right, not just at Utah State, but all the schools across the state, our system of higher education will be much stronger in the future. But change is hard and it's a challenge.
In fact, I was going through your slide presentation. You gave a presentation. One of the feedback from I think it's maybe students or maybe the entire university that they gave you feedback on was they were kind of tired of upheaval, change, fast change, right?
Yeah, there is a lot of exhaustion around that because it has, kind of since COVID, it feels like, we went through the COVID scenario and came back from that. And then there were the changes in the state legislation even before what was passed federally about around diversity, equity, and inclusion. And then we got into the strategic reinvestment side of things. So our faculty and staff in particular and students feel like, it's been one thing after another. Can we just get to a little bit more of a status quo state? And I understand that that's where people want to be, but the world is changing and we need to think about how to do that strategically. And so we're gonna, as I'm, getting into almost my 3rd month here at USU, we're really gonna try to launch some strategic planning so that we can be thoughtful about the changes we do in the future and really want to lean into learning how we can better serve the students and that statewide land grant mission that Utah State is uniquely assigned.
And I want to pick that up a little later in this conversation. Important that strategic planning. So before we go to the legislative audit, just one more thing on HB 265. Do you feel, and does the legislature feel that you've met their criteria? That they wanted more emphasis on degrees for high-end needs in Utah, right? Higher earning majors, right? To get people into higher earning jobs, increase efficiencies. I can't remember what the other criteria were.
Yeah, that's basically it. Just really trying to focus in on programs that where students will be able to meet workforce needs that we have across the state and that will provide a good return on investment for students for the time and money that they put into getting their education. And so the message we really, I feel like we got from legislators back in December was there wasn't a concern about Utah State's plan anymore. They felt like our plan had aligned in a direction that was supportive of their objectives. They just wanted to make sure that we had extra incentive, I guess you might say, to take the findings from the legislative audit seriously. And so they, and where that was coming just a few weeks later, they said, well, let's give you some money so you can get started on the reinvestments, but hold out to see what the legislative audit determines and how we think you're responding to that.
All right, and some listeners are saying, "Well, you sure buried the lead about the audit." But I wanted to get to a little background before we did that. So let's get to that. The legislature ordered an audit of USU's governance, leadership, and culture. So tell me about some of the findings and USU's responses to that.
Yeah, so their legislative auditors came in after. They did some initial work last summer after some things were reported in the newspaper and other outlets about some of the spending patterns that were happening at USU that were a little bit disturbing. So they came in and really did a deep dive on that. Some of the key findings were that they felt like there was some financial non-compliance, bypassing the requirements that are established in state law for purchasing. And that also are in university policies. And then they looked kind of at just our budgetary model and how we distribute resources at Utah State and whether that really recognizes the value of teaching and teaching in those similar to what the Strategic Reinvestment Program was at, those high demand programs that are really going to be a benefit to students. Is there as much emphasis on that as there is on research when we're distributing our resources? And then another area from the audit really focused on how our system of higher education in the state is evaluating presidents and supporting them and the monitoring of presidential activities that happens both from our Utah State Board of Trustees and the State Board of Higher Education. Then there were some internal issues about are we dealing with the role of our internal audit staff and with the general counsel staff in an appropriate way. And so those are all areas where, as a university, we're taking the findings from the audit. We're concurring with all of their findings. We're really not disputing anything that they identified. And even before I started, our Board of Trustees started to adopt new policies where they'd monitor presidential expenditures and how purchases at a certain level needed to have a higher threshold of review before they could occur. And so we're really trying to take the findings of the audit seriously. I think that if we when we let things occur that are outside of policy or outside of the state law requirements, it just creates a lot of controversy and it distracts us from focusing on our main mission around serving students and the excellent research that our faculty are doing, the extension programs that are having an impact all across the state. And so we want to reestablish that culture and rebuild the trust, both internal to campus and from our stakeholders and from our constituents in Cache Valley and all throughout Utah. And so we're taking this very seriously, and we've laid out a plan. There's some 27 recommendations for us to take action on in the audit, and not all of them apply to Utah State. Some of them apply to the Commissioner of Higher Education in the state and the State Board of Higher Education and the legislature even. But we're taking those remaining 18 or 19 that are directed at us, and we've kind of said we hear you, and we'll adjust our policies and our practices, and really try to demonstrate from a leadership perspective that we want to do things in a transparent and open and fair way.
Any, I won't ask you to name all 18, but any top of mind things that you're going to be working on from those recommendations?
A couple of things that I'm actually excited about and think will help. I think there's some scrutiny, as there rightfully should be, around what are all the perks that a president gets and what is some of the spending there. And so having this, our Board of Trustees, we've already started at our January meeting. They approved a budget for the president's office for the final 6 months of this fiscal year, and then we'll be reporting to them on that quarterly, and we'll go through if there are expenditures that or at a higher level or without or outside the scope of that budget that they've approved. We need to take it to them first in order to get their buy-off on that. And And that might be a bit of a hassle, but I view it as, this is something that it'll help keep me out of trouble and keep people from questioning what I'm doing so that I can do the work that the president needs to do in terms of building relationships with other partners and providing leadership for the institution, hopefully modeling that we do follow those policies. So I really welcome all of that. And then there was another piece of emphasis in the audit that, we have had, it's also been reported sometimes in some of our statewide programs, maybe there hasn't been as close of monitoring over employee circumstances that arise and whether they're doing the work that they're getting paid to do. And coming back from our statewide tour that we did a couple of weeks ago now and seeing the impact and the potential of our statewide campuses, it really, I'm excited to make sure that they're getting the support that they need, both administratively and from a resource perspective. The audit challenges us to do more of that. And there just is so much potential there, and the impact for the students in those rural communities and for the communities themselves is so great that I really think that we'll be better at doing that as we follow some of the recommendations that are in the legislative audit.
Will are you confident USU will be getting the remaining 70% of that money, reinvestment money?
So the it's still a several step process. We're very optimistic, I would say, that we're on the path that the legislature, while they're in session here, that adjourns early in March, that they'll approve the remaining 70%. The audit, in addition to being reported in the Legislative Audit Committee Friday, will go to the Higher Education Appropriations Subcommittee on February 9th, I believe it is. And then ultimately, it's the Executive Appropriations Committee of the legislature that will release the 70% of the funds. So we'll make sure that we're sharing with all of those groups, but the early indications are that legislators, we had a very collaborative working relationship with the legislative audit staff, and they felt like they commended us on working with them throughout the audit, and they're feeling good about our responses to the recommendations that they've had, and that's kind of where it starts. But we'll continue to make sure that the other legislators know that we're taking this seriously and want to adjust the tone and the culture that allowed some of these issues of concern to arise in the past. And hopefully through that, we'll be able to get the rest of the funding restored here in the next 4 weeks or so.
Well, in the meantime, there's never a dull moment. Legislature has asked, I think, all state agencies to model a potential 5% budget cut. How likely do you think that's going to stay at that 5% level? And what's USU thinking about in terms of that?
Yeah, at this point, we did have to provide some recommendations that we of if we did take a 5% cut, and it's a 10% cut one session is different than a 5% cut the next. Just they define what the denominator is in different ways. So this 5% actually has the potential to be more impactful to us, more in the range of $18 million than the 10% cut was, because it was on a smaller percentage of our budget. So we've said things that we would not be able to do some of those reinvestments that we had planned in those areas. We would just kind of have to take the cuts and not redeploy those funds, that we might have to, look at other open positions and not fill vacancies. We've kept it very general at this point because there has been so much change on campus, well, across the university already, that we don't want folks to get too anxious. Both the system of higher education and the legislative budget staff have made different types of recommendations, like not holding back on tuition waivers or not funding building projects and some of those things to generate the 5% cut savings. I'm hopeful, though, and we're really, as other presidents, trying to send out a strong message that, look, we've had a 1.5% cut 2 sessions ago, a strategic reinvestment plan last year, that other state agencies haven't gone through. I know there are demands all across the state, but higher education has been carrying their share of the weight when it comes to helping balance the state budget, and we should be given a pass this time. And I say that, knowing that my friends in corrections and public safety and health and human services and other key agencies across the state want the pass too. But we're arguing for that for now, and we'll find out here before the session concludes if that becomes a reality or not.
So as you head into your strategic planning, what are sort of your guiding lights? What are your top priorities?
Thank you for asking. And to me, there are four critical areas that we want to focus on at Utah State. And I think they're things that everyone in the Aggie community will rally behind. First, really, as a land grant institution, leaning into those statewide programs and helping to support them and the impact they have in their various communities across the state. That is something that, I invite everyone to. We're going to go back on another statewide tour, and it was just so fascinating. And every community is a little bit different, but the relationship they have and the investment that communities have made, from Vernal to Blanding and Tooele and in Price and Moab, it's really inspiring to see how much people value and want higher education there. And so we have the obligation to serve those folks and want to make sure that we figure out how we can do that in the best way we can. I really think we can do better at Utah State around helping students get through their pathways, their academic pathways, to a degree in a meaningful time frame, in a more accelerated time frame, and in a time frame that they don't have to stop out and never complete, because the value from higher education really, I mean, there's a lot of places where you gain value, but having that degree at the end of the day is where people really realize the most in terms of benefit for their not just lifelong earnings, but their health and their unemployment and happiness. There's so many studies that show that that's the critical point. And there are some things that we can do to streamline that process for students that I'm excited to undertake as an institution. There's so much great research happening at USU, and we have a real strong position to help address some of the biggest challenges in Utah right now, whether that's our land use, our air quality, water needs. We're a leader in space with the partnership with the Space Dynamics Lab, and I think that we can continue to grow that foundation. And then one of my personal pet issues, I guess, is higher education is the place where we can model how to be true citizens and to make sure that we're respectful, and even if, when we don't agree, that we can debate issues passionately but not get to the hateful and disrespectful about that. So bringing that civility forward in all that we do is something that I want to emphasize, and those will be the pillars of our strategic planning. But we want to embrace the Aggie community broadly, faculty, staff, students, alumni, and other stakeholders, and refine some key objectives that we can achieve over that in the next handful of years, and set some goals and chart our progress, and be very transparent about the progress that we make and how we can do better.
I noticed you did a student survey, I think, very early on, like
On the first day.
day one or something. One thing jumped out at me. You talked a little bit about that. I wonder, have you expand on this? I'll just read this. Students repeatedly cited structural barriers, parking, transportation, affordability, including tuition, administrative bureaucracy, and consistent academic workload. So that affordability piece, that remains a concern.
And there are a lot of studies, and I just read one the other day that affordability is really, what causes students to stop out more than anything else. And usually when, it's usually if a student will have some other incident outside of their education come up in their life. Maybe their car breaks down, maybe they get a medical bill, or their family situation changes, and they about the time tuition is due, and so they think, well, I can't pay tuition this semester. I'll just stop out for a semester and work, and then I'll be back. And it's just we know that that momentum to overcome the challenge and then get back in school keeps students out. And so, one thing we're trying to do is we've launched a scholarship fund that will help students who are in that circumstance, the Utah State Promise Scholarship Endowment, that hopefully we can raise some funds to help even more students be able to stay in school when they meet that challenge. But also, I think, and this is going to take us a little bit of time to figure out. I don't know that we'll be able to roll it out for next academic year, but through the strategic planning, and we want to be careful in our modeling. I think there are ways that we can be more transparent in what our charges are for students early on, so that, another thing that'll stop a student from paying their tuition bill is all of a sudden they realize there's some charge for a course fee or a book or something that's more than they were expecting. So they're like, I don't have enough money to go to school this semester, and it's might just be a few hundred dollars. I think we can package that better and even, provide students like, this is not just your amount for this semester, but this is the amount for your full degree, and we can guarantee that over the course of your education, and allow that families and students to plan better. So I'm excited to try to pursue some of those initiatives. We have to safeguard making the revenue capacity of the university on one hand to make sure that we can still pay all the faculty and staff and the other bills. But I think there are some ways that we can be a little more transparent up front and provide some bridges for students who do get into a place where their finances force them to consider whether they can continue.
Finally, you did a statewide campus tour, right? Down to
Yes.
Blanding, over to Tooele, I think, Uinta Basin. What's your top couple takeaways from that tour?
Oh, it was, we spent 4 days, and we went Brigham City, Tooele, Vernal, Roosevelt, Moab, Blanding, Price, and then stopped in Salt Lake going out and coming back. And each of those campuses has a passionate set of faculty and staff who are there to serve students. And the students who are being served there are taking it, are passionate about pursuing their education, but maybe don't have the means or ability to leave home or the finances to come to Logan. And so it's just so important that they have that opportunity to get their education, whether it's a nurse in Moab or someone getting their truck driver CDL license in Blanding, and then seeing students studying accounting and entrepreneurship in Roosevelt. And it's so fascinating to realize the quality of the education that's happening and the impact it has locally for the students and those communities. And folks are just thriving and so dedicated to that effort. It really just makes you proud to be associated with Utah State and all those communities. That same way, I think folks typically associate with USU and Logan and Cache Valley. So it was just a great opportunity. I'm going back to a basketball game in Price here in a couple weeks, and we're planning to get out for commencement activities all across the state, and already started planning the next tour and who we're going to take with us. So it's a real feather in the cap of USU to have the statewide campuses, and something that I hope that we can continue to facilitate and grow.
We've been talking with Utah State University President Brad Mortensen. Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Tom. Always good to listen to you, and appreciate the great work that you do keeping us informed.
You're listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Our thanks to USU President Brad Mortensen for that interview. We have obviously some more time in this hour, and following a break, we're going to revisit a conversation from March of 2018. Author Kate Moore, talking about her impactful book, The Radium Girls. Subtitle is The Dark Story of America's Shining Women. We'll have a portion of that interview following this break. You're listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're going to close out this hour with a portion of my interview from March of 2018 with Kate Moore. The book is called The Radium Girls. Subtitles: The Dark Story of America's Shining Women. Here's a bit of the synopsis. The Curies, a newly discovered element of radium, makes gleaming headlines across the nation as fresh face of beauty and a wonder drug of the medical community. From body lotion to tonic water, the popular new element shines bright in the otherwise dark years of the First World War. Meanwhile, hundreds of girls toil amidst the glowing dust of radium-dialed factories. The glittering chemical covers their bodies from head to toe. They light up the night like industrious fireflies. With such coveted jobs, these shiny girls are the luckiest alive until they begin to fall mysteriously ill. But the factories that once offered golden opportunities are now ignoring all claims of the gruesome side effects, the women's cries of corruption. As the fatal poison of radium takes hold, the brave, shining girls find themselves embroiled in one of the biggest scandals of America's early 20th century in a groundbreaking battle for workers' rights. Here's a portion of my interview from 2018 with Kate Moore. Now, you have written that your mission here is to witness for these women, right? And to help us to know them. So I want you to maybe to talk about a few of them, maybe starting with one of the central figures in this book. I think she was a central figure in the play. It's right. That's Catherine Donahue, we've been talking
about. Yeah, Catherine Donahue, who she was the lead litigant in the Illinois case. And you're quite right. She was the leading character in the play I directed. So she was really my way into this story. So it's been a wonderful privilege to write about her, an extraordinary experience for me as an author as well, to have met someone who is a real person through a play. And then through my research for the book, I obviously came to her hometown. I visited her house. I went to her church and sat, you know, under the same vaulted ceiling that she once did. I visited her grave, I met with her family members, her nephews, her nieces, and, you know, really wanted to know who she was, because my mission in writing The Radium Girls was to bring each of these women to life. So I can now tell you that Catherine Donahue was not your sort of stereotypical, you know, battler for justice, really. She was a very quiet woman. She was incredibly devout. One of the most upsetting things for her about her radium poisoning is that it so sort of fixed the bones in place. They sort of fused in a way. It meant that she was unable to kneel and pray in church. And that for her was absolutely devastating. She had to take communion at home after that. So she was a very ordinary woman, but in my eyes, an extraordinary ordinary woman, because when she found herself caught up in this tragedy, despite the fact that she wasn't necessarily a personality who would, you know, perhaps be very driven and very noisy and, you know, all of those kind of things that we might imagine someone that is a lead litigant in a case to be, she thought, you know, she knew it was the right thing to do. And, you know, imagine this story. Imagine being Catherine Donahue, seeing your friends sickening around you, seeing the woman who used to sit opposite you in his valet, seeing her die. You know, it would give you the strength to keep fighting on. And so Catherine did that. She was a mother. She had two young children when she died, who were also, it seems, physically affected by the radium poisoning. And that is just one of the stories that you will read about in The Radium Girls. She was this extraordinary, ordinary woman. And as I say, it's been a privilege to get to know her better through her letters, through her newspaper interviews, and through her family members who I met.
I think it's the photograph we've been talking about. Maybe it's a different one. There's Catherine's husband, Tom's, leaning over her, bending, you know, solicitously over her. That illustrates the other part of the story. You mentioned the children. Of course, Tom Donahue loses his wife early. And it seems like
that was something that I really wanted to bring out in this book, because as we've touched on in this interview, you know, the Radium Girls have had this extraordinary legacy in terms of workers' rights, in terms of legal legislation to sort of ensure, you know, healthful working practices, an incredible scientific legacy. But for me, what was essential and what was important and what I wanted the book to do was to focus on the women and their personal stories. So that includes, you know, what is it like for a husband to lose his wife at such a young age. You know, Catherine was 35 when she died. And the book is actually dedicated to the Radium Girls and those who loved them. And it explores those personal tragedies. So it looks at Albina, for example, who was unable to have children, who had a stillbirth, you know, because of the radium poisoning. And it looks at Tom, you know, Tom and Catherine's story for me was just this heartbreaking love story. You know, when Catherine was too sick to walk anymore, Tom would carry her around in his arms. You know, he carries her to the courtroom to give evidence because she's too weak to get there, but he carries her there because that's what she wants more than anything, is to give evidence against this firm that has killed her, that has robbed her of the chance to be a mother to her children. And Catherine was someone who was also orphaned at a young age. So for me, that was just something, you know, how do you feel when you've been orphaned yourself to know that you're going to leave your children without a mother? I just think it's so distressing to think about these personal realities of what these historical figures went through, because hopefully in my book they're not historical anymore. Hopefully you meet Tom and Catherine and Grace and the children, Tommy and Mary Jane, and you appreciate the human story and the human reality and heartache behind these facts. That's what I hope.
You understand you kept photographs of these women next to your desk as you're writing this, I guess, to keep them present?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you can probably tell as I talk about them, you know, I felt this personal connection with them. And that was true when I was directing the play all the way through to writing the book. But yes, you're quite right. I wrote with photographs of them displayed around my desk. So as I was writing about Albina's, you know, stillborn baby, or as I was writing about, you know, Grace's death, I could look at the women, I could look them in the eyes, as you can in a photograph. And, you know, this book is really dedicated to them. This book is a platform for them and their stories and their voices to speak out. That's what I really wanted to do, was to give the Radium Girls a voice.
Maybe you could talk a little bit about how you found their voice. Of course, you had photographs. You're able to find letters, right? Of course, the court transcripts.
Yeah, absolutely. I came to America for a month and traveled around researching the Radium Girl. So, as I say, you know, part of that was following in their footsteps, so to actually go to their hometowns and the places that were important to them. But it was also looking in museums and archives and libraries, you know, looking for their letters, looking for their diaries, for the newspaper interviews that they gave at the time, for their court testimonies where they're on the stand, you know, describing in their own words exactly what happened to them. And all of those first person quotations from the Radium Girls themselves are stitched into the narrative of my book. So I hope to read it is actually to read their story in their own words. You know, it's filled with quotations from the Radium Girls themselves.
I wonder, one of the women who especially stood out to me is Peg Looney, am I saying that correctly?
Yes.
Tell me a little bit about her.
Peg was wonderful. She was a redhead. She's a very slender girl. She was prone to giggling fits. And she was very scholarly. So she actually wanted to be a school teacher when she, you know, grew up, as it were. That was her ambition. But she came from a very poor family, and she needed to get a job. And so she got a job as a dial painter, which, as I say, was very well paid. And she was a very generous young woman. So her family remembered that she would share that good fortune with them. You know, as I say, she came from a large family, so she had lots of brothers and sisters, and she would buy one of her little sisters, you know, a beautiful dress for her eighth grade graduation. You know, she was a very sort of giving person. And what happened to Peg is really quite shocking. And without giving away, you know, too much that is described in the book, she gets sick. You know, one of the shocking things is the medical treatment that the Radium Girls receive or don't receive. So one of the things that happened to Peg to treat her was that they put an ice pack on her chest. I'm not quite sure how that was supposed to battle, you know, the radioactivity in her bones, but that was what she endured. And the firm that had employed her kept a very close eye on her decline. And as I say, I won't give any spoilers, but suffice it to say that the firm had a vested interest in what happened to Peg after she died, and they weren't prepared to give up the power that they'd had over her as her employer. They carried that on even after death.
Yeah, it's quite the story. I wonder, you talked to several relatives.
That's right.
What
So,
was?
with Peg in particular, I spoke to her niece, Darlene. And Darlene was actually born after Peg had died, because Peg obviously died, very young. But Darlene said that because Peg's sisters used to talk about her so much, and actually I met one of those sisters, Jean, as well, who was able to talk to me about Peg. Darlene said because the sisters had all talked about Peg so much, Darlene felt as though she knew her. She was just as much a relative as all her other aunts and uncles were. For me, it was really important that I spoke to the family members, and they were all very generous in sharing their recollections, their photograph albums, sharing these family stories that had been passed down, through the generations. Obviously, some of them are first hand because they're from sisters or sons or daughters. And I really wanted to understand, what each individual radium girl was like, who was quiet, who was a flirt, who was the one that would always get the party started. And that's what the family members were able to tell me, as well as to describe the sick rooms and, what really happened towards the end as well, and how the poisoning affected these women, these real women.
We'll talk a little bit about larger effects. I know that there's a connection to the Manhattan Project.
That's right. This is part of this extraordinary legacy that the Radium Girls has left us. So they were painting originally in the First World War. And so all these things we've talked about happening, the mystery of what was hurting them, the fight for justice that they then pursued through the courts, all of this happens over the following years. So by the time the Second World War comes around, which of course the Manhattan Project was part of that global conflict, the Radium Girls have established that radioactive materials are dangerous if you're working with them. So the legacy that they left is that Glenn Seaborg, who was a leading scientist working on the Manhattan Project, he actually wrote in his diary that as he was making his rounds through the laboratories of the Manhattan Project one night, he was struck by a vision of the workers in the radium dial painting industry. He remembered Grace Fryer and Catherine Donahue, and he remembered what had happened to them. And because of that, he insisted that they undertake research into plutonium and the radioactive materials they were using for the atomic bomb to find out, well, is this material dangerous? And it was proven that actually the materials they were using on the Manhattan Project were biomedically very similar to radium. And so because the Radium Girls had sort of flagged this warning, it meant that Seaborg could then insist that workers on the Manhattan Project had to be protected. And so safety measurements were put in place on that project that were based directly on what scientists had learned from the bodies of the Radium Girls. So, the amount of time that they were allowed to be exposed to it, the fact that they couldn't handle it in a certain way. And because of that, the Manhattan Project was largely conducted in safety for the workers. If it hadn't been for the Radium Girls, many more people would have died and would have felt the effects like way beyond the Second World War. And the Atomic Energy Commission actually described the Radium Girls' contribution as invaluable after the war.
We just have a few minutes left here in the conversation. One of your main goals is to help us to get to know the Radium Girls themselves and to give them voice. And so I wonder, what do you think they would say if they were speaking to us today?
Well, I mean, that's interesting, isn't it? Obviously, their voices are in the book, so we know what we thought about what happened to them. What would they think about today? I mean, I think they'd probably be saddened that we still fight the same battles, that there are still corporate cover-ups, that, you know, we still need regulations and we still need to call out injustice where we see it. And I hope, too, that they would be proud of those activists who are doing, you know, just as the Radium Girls themselves did in standing up for your rights and standing up for what is right, because that's what the girls did. And I hope, you know, their voices shine out through this book, and I hope their voices inspire people who read it today to sort of follow in the girls' footsteps and to echo those voices through time.
I don't know if you have your book with you.
I do. I have a copy
you,
right here.
You do. Yeah. I wonder, I'm just haunted by the quote you have in the front of the book from the Ottawa High School yearbook.
Yeah.
I wonder if you'd
read
that.
I just thought that was
for...
perfect when I found it in I found it in the high school yearbook in Ottawa Public Library. Yeah.
This is Ottawa High School yearbook, 1925.
Yeah. Would you like me to read it out?
Yes.
I shall never forget you. Hearts that know you love you, and lips that have given you laughter, have gone to their lifetime of grief and of roses, searching for dreams that they lost in the world far away from your walls.
And, as you know, we don't know. I guess we don't know who wrote that. It's just
actually,
part of the yearbook.
As you say, it's a quotation that is perfectly apt for this story. But actually, the Your Walls is directed at the high school itself. The kind of you, the you in the quote is actually the school. So we don't know who wrote it. There was no attribution in the yearbook. But it's when I found it, I was just like, this is perfect. This needs to go in the book, because for me as well, it kind of has a sense of the sort of the poetry and the tragedy of what happens to them, you know, their lifetime of grief and of roses, dreams that they lost in the world. But these are young girls who, you know, they didn't get to see much of the world because, you know, they were sick by the time they're in their 20s. Many of them die at that same age. And it just sort of captured that feeling for me of this poignant tragedy, this preventable tragedy, and the kind of the nature of these young women to whom it happened.
So the book's been out several months. Paperback is just coming out. It's gotten, you know, a lot of attention. New York Times bestseller. What kinds of reaction are you getting from readers? What has surprised you from that, or if any?
The reaction has just been wonderful, and I'm so touched. You know, particularly the reason I'm particularly touched that it's been so successful in America is because these women in their lifetime, you know, were shunned and silenced by the company and disbelieved, and, you know, even in their own communities, you know, people didn't want them to cause a fuss. You know, particularly in Illinois during the Great Depression, you know, the idea of suing your company, you know, suing your employer when so many millions of Americans are out of work, you know, that was not a popular choice for the Radium Girls to pursue this fight for justice. So the fact that America has now sort of embraced and celebrated them just means such a lot to me. So I'm so grateful for people, you know, for reading it, for recognizing how important they are, how courageous they are. I think the surprise for me is just that the book has, you know, been as successful as it is, because I thought they were amazing, but I didn't know if anyone else would. And I'm just delighted that it has had that impact. I think readers are connecting with the girls themselves, and that is all I could ask. You know, several reviewers and people have written that the girls live again in this book, and that's something I'm very proud of.
Yeah, it must be very pleasing to you, the central purpose of the book, as I've understood it. What about you personally? You've lived, quote unquote, with these women for a while now.
Yeah, I mean, and that is another wonderful thing about its success because I get to be here talking to you about them. So, you know, someone asked me the other day, you know, was it sad when, you know, what was your emotion when you finished writing the book? And were you sad? And yes, I was sad because it kind of felt a bit like goodbye, you know, because I'd reached the end. But actually, it's not the end because, as I say, I'm still talking about them. I still get to live with them. I get to celebrate them, to take their message out to readers. And the fact that their voices are now in this book and being heard means that actually the story is never over because, you know, next year or the year after or 10 years down the line, someone can always find this book and they can listen to these women's voices. And that is something that I'm personally, you know, delighted about because these girls had been forgotten. People hadn't followed their stories. They hadn't remembered them, who they were as individuals and what they suffered and what they achieved. And I'm just delighted that a record now exists.
Well, thank you very much. A fascinating story, important story. Kate Moore has joined us. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much for the opportunity that you've given me to talk about them. Thank you.